The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, Nerdapalooza, the world's largest nerd music festival, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other fine Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com. Welcome to Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts, the podcast where we go behind the scenes of Atomic Robo, your favorite action science comic. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hey, I'm Brian.
And I'm Scott.
And we are going to talk about Atomic Robo Volume 8, Issue 1, The Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur. Not very long ago, the three of us got together live in person at Heroes Con, and we did a panel. We've released it online. We'll link to where you can listen to that on this episode's page. Where we discussed Dr. Dinosaur and his first two Free Comic Book Day appearances in 2009 and 2011. This story arc is all about the madness that is Dr. Dinosaur. So if you are looking for a primer, that's where you should go to. And if you are looking for the latest in awesome science adventure from Atomic Robo, and you want to know what's going on in the brains behind this fabulous comic, well, you've come to the right place.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Dudes, this has been on the books for a while. I mean, most Robo stuff is on the books for a while, but this one has always been... I'm kind of amazed that we got here. You know, I've been hearing about the Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur for years, kind of like this looming, ridiculous thing that, you know, I couldn't possibly... It's only real until it's real, and now it's real.
Welcome to our world, where we yeah. know what we're doing years in advance, and it's like, you know, we're just waiting and waiting and waiting to pull it off.
Has this book changed a lot since you first mentioned slash and announced it, like in passing?
I feel like it's exactly what was intended all along.
Okay.
I don't know. I've been trying not to think about it because I knew I'd have to draw lots of Dr. Dinosaur.
As we learned in the panel, your Dr. Dinosaur has changed quite a bit.
He has.
Time.
Yeah, he has.
He's very unstable from all the time-volution energies that he's
timey-wimey stuff, yeah. You know, I actually had no expectations going into this one. This was definitely something Brian's thought about a lot more than I did. Because I just knew if I thought about it too hard, I would get all, you know, full of anxiety and be like, oh God, dinosaurs and hard to draw and so annoying.
Well, how about this then? You know, from the title, fans could anticipate wacky Dr. Dinosaur action. And then from page one, what we get is some really heavy Robo story and dark, dark times. Like the first issue is a lot darker than I'm sure anybody bargained for from the Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur.
Well, you know, you got to ease into that. You can't just start with wackety schmackety.
we're creating contrast is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Up on the surface, it's a very sane world. It's a world that's sadly very familiar to us, at least as portrayed here with the 24-hour news and all the just asking questions. When we go to Hollow Earth, it is quite literally a whole different world.
Well, let me propose this. I feel that with Volume 8, for the first time ever, Atomic Robo has hit a point where you cannot just grab any old volume and read it and be good with it. This one is very seeped in Robo continuity. And
I don't know, because this first panel basically tells you.
Right. So let's say you've never read Volume 6, which this is all referring to. You can read through all, because, you know, it's funny because we keep referring to 811 in this issue, but it doesn't have a name yet when it happens in Volume 6. So you need to infer one way or the other anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
You kind of put it together with, you know, they're talking about Battleship Island and all that jazz. And if you've read the other volumes recently, it should trigger that so you know what's going on. But if you've never read this, I think all the information is here that something happened. And, you know, Robo is suspected one way or another of being involved in nefarious plots. And that's really all you need to know. Reading Volume 6 will do nothing to make this volume any richer, I don't think, other than,
yeah,
you know, having
just
a slightly...
knowing that Robo's kind of in trouble in a way.
Yeah.
But again, we kind of get that right here. So
you get the building blocks, but I think if, say, a new reader picked this up, they would be like diving into the deep end. You know,
I think maybe, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I agree.
Could they survive it? Yeah, they could survive it, but it's way more of a learning curve than ever before.
That's true.
That is true. Yeah, that is true. And I think I may have voiced a couple of concerns about that when we first started working on this, Brian.
Whatever, you're the artist.
Exactly. Yeah, that's usually how that goes. But I think it's a valid comment. It's less obvious to me because I've been working on it. It's even less obvious to you because you wrote it.
Oh, yeah.
So there's always that way to factor in. But I still think this, you don't have to have read anything in order to understand the general scenario going on here and why Robo might be looking for an excuse to get out of the office.
Sure. How about the name 811? Granted, we're many, many, many years past 9/11, and it's semi-okay to crack jokes now and all that, but it's pretty ballsy move there, you know.
Now where I live.
Okay, well, depending on where you live, it either is or isn't okay to crack jokes. Based on a morbid tragedy, sure, okay.
No, I didn't think of it as a joke so much as I try to think of the most cynical possible thing that nonstop media would try to call this if they're just trying to make any kind of desperate case that Robo Badman.
Right.
And since, by sheer coincidence, because we did not plan this at all, Volume 6, the first issue, was released in August of 2011. The events of that comic take place over like 4 days, maybe. So it happened in August 2011. So 8/11 is what you would do if you were this massive media shit pile and you just want Robo Badman to kind of resonate with people.
I mean, you've seen
CNN and Fox. These are not good channels.
They're not nice people. Yeah.
No. The only thing that bummed me out on this first page is that a bunch of my text got taken out of the hollow screens because I'd written it in really badly by hand, but then it never got put in because I don't think there was some confusion on who's doing what on that. And then I was so busy trying to get stuff done, I never really went back and looked close enough. But there was this great little, like, the ranty guy in the middle there is basically Bill O'Reilly, but his show is the O'Reilly Show.
we'll fix it after the trade.
Yeah, sure, for the trade. And then I forget what the lady on the right there, the blonde, but she was supposed to be like an Ann Coulter kind of uptight, see you next Tuesday kind of lady. That panel was a little intimidating to work on.
There's a lot going on there.
There is a lot going on. I got to say, man, this new paper we're using is gorgeous. It's so good. So for years, I've wanted to use a less glossy page in Robo, and it's come up once or twice in conversations, but I really, really stuck with it this time because I really thought that a lot of the transition between what we see digitally and then what we see in print, as far as the coloring was going with the way Nick colors, was in large part due to the kind of paper we were using. And I think this works awesome. We worked out a couple of like the last final technical twitches, but definitely the way the color sits on this paper is now it's very close to how it looks digitally. And I am super happy with it.
It looks fantastic.
It's got such a great depth to it, and it's nice and matte and so good.
So you guys have actually changed the paper you're printing the books on.
Yes.
Was that a decision you made or a decision Red 5 made?
This was a decision that I guess I kind of did on my own and then kind of got Red 5 to do for me.
That's cool.
I had a hunch it would work a lot better. And
it did.
Usually I'm wrong, so this was exciting.
Yeah, I got one.
Yay!
With a panel that has as much text in it as this first panel does, was this something that you took into account, the specific text layout, Scott?
No, I didn't actually. Yes and no, I should say. I read through it. I kind of made a mental map of how many bubbles there would be and how large and what kind of real estate they would take up on the page. But then I just, with the exception of having Bill O'Reilly front and center there, I just went for stuff that would look provocative one way or other. So I put in the upper right hand there is the office building that Robo gets attacked in Volume 6, where the helicopter comes down and fire, shoots out the whole floor of the building. Mm-hmm. Then the chase scene starts and the Russian nuke and all that, just because there were missing nukes and, everyone loves a little Cold War paranoia. And then, like I said, Ann Coulter, the next awful person I could think of after Bill O'Reilly was Ann Coulter. So I put her in, so I just kind of went that way. And then I Googled Fox newscasts and just started drawing the people that I saw. And then that last one I was kind of stretching. So it's just like, yeah, Robo with a no smoking sign through his head.
That image is perfectly Robo Badman.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then I was just kind of looking for little pieces that we've seen in Robo. So that weird little egg robot that's mostly covered by the screens and whatnot is something that has cropped up in his office in several volumes, just as a thing he has that maybe someday we'll get to explain, but probably not.
Robo mentions that he tries out TV every few years to just in case someone screwed up and made it worth watching again. When, in Robo's opinion, was the last time TV was worth watching? What's his favorite show?
When Milton Berle was on, probably.
Probably. I would say very early television, just after radio.
Yeah. It's kind of an opinion that I think you and I share also. Yeah. It's less Robo's opinion and more ours.
Yeah, Scott and I are about 83 years old. in a lot of ways.
Well, no. So when television was new, you know, I'm kind of half joking about Milton Berle, but he was one of the big proponents of this. Television was seen in some circles as this amazing teaching tool, literally a way to unite the world and exchange ideas. What we wanted the internet to be before it became a porn and
before Reddit
happened and that stuff. So the potential that we see in the internet today is the same potential that people saw on television back then. And efforts were made to bring culture to the masses, and they would have, you know, symphonic performances and lectures and stuff like that, until they realized that what people really wanted was, you know, farts and Three Stooges. It's not a failure of the medium. It's a failure of the audience, I guess.
Another fun fact is that Robo is not a fan of movies starting with when they introduced talkies.
Well, I would say the first 10 years of talkies, before the regulations all started in the 20s, that's film was actually pretty...
They could do some cool stuff.
Oh, yeah, they did some crazy stuff, some very risky, some very socially challenging stuff. And then
cinematographically very mature.
Mm-hmm.
But the talkies kind of brought the idea of, you know, okay, the camera has to be still. And now it's just, we're just watching this play. And it just really killed the creativity of worldwide cinema. Kind of an unintended consequence.
Not that nothing good has come out of films, but as a whole, yeah.
But yeah, Robo, you know, has... a grandpa, basically. It's just going to have this old opinion about it.
So we've got this team of action scientists and Bernard, who, as usual, isn't quite where he wants to be.
Oh, Bernard.
Yeah, poor Bernard. Bernard's the best, though.
he's Coulson, but we don't have to kill him.
Right.
Well, hey, you just bring him back anyway.
Yeah, we'll just make a life model decoy. Hey, kids, I am fine.
he is probably the most fun of all. Yeah, him and then Lang are my two favorite action scientists to mess around with. I think they have the most personality out of all of them. Vic's been growing on me this volume.
Mm-hmm.
So then on Tesladyne Island, we see this Tesladyne employee walking up. She's got crazy hair and some nose jewelry and all that. So I figure you guys... have a history of putting friends of yours in the book. Is this another friend of yours?
Yes, and I'm hoping this is the last time we do this, because I never quite get our friends correct. Oh. Although I think I know this is my friend Elle Nichols. She's a artist from Brooklyn who I met a few years ago when I moved here, and she is just totally rad. And I've seen her several times in a bow tie, and she looks awesome in one. So I figured she would wear one to work at Tesladyne.
You're a bow tie connoisseur. You stopped somebody right before the Heroes Con panel we did to find out where awesome the bow tie came from.
I'm always curious. I'm looking for new sources for interesting bow ties.
Spot that tie.
Yeah. But I thought Elle would be great because in real life, she graduated from MIT. She's an engineer, and then she got her master's in art education also at MIT. So she's into the math. She's into the art. She incorporates a lot of math into her artwork and whatnot. And
That's very cool.
Along with Phil, who is Robo's, what do we call him? He's not really his doctor. He's the...
He kind of is his doctor, though.
Yeah, but what's his official? He's like in charge of the nuclear liaison guy at Tesla. Yeah, yeah. The two of them, of all of our real life friends, they're like the only ones who actually would make legitimate... Tesladyne employees, which is kind of I found that really fun so far in this volume, because the two of them are kind of interacting with them, with each other, and with the make-believe characters. Elle is a blast to draw. The mohawk is fun. I'm always forgetting which ear has like three earrings and which one has two, and trying to...
it's comics.
Yeah, so she finds a thing.
She finds the thing and she runs back to Jenkins. And I'm really excited at how this is shaping up to have not just a bunch of Dr. Dinosaur in it eventually, but also a very substantial Jenkins subplot. That's
yes.
Cool to me. Is that a promise that this Jenkins stuff, is this going to do it for me? Am I going to get the substantial amount of Jenkins I've been craving?
Maybe not as much as you've been craving.
Oh, I crave so much Jenkins.
We never deliver that much.
That much would not be safe. But Jenkins is the focal point of the B plot of this volume. So while Robo is off having this adventure in Hollow Earth, Jenkins is left to hold down the fort, quite literally at some points.
As we see on this page.
Yeah, and seemingly doing all the important shit.
Yeah, cleaning his guns, inventorying his bullets. Yeah, Jenkins stuff. Wearing a tie because he's acting CEO.
Cleaning up Robo's messes. While Robo's yes. gallivanting off in the Hollow Earth with his pal Dr. Dinosaur.
That's what Jenkins does.
The original odd couple.
Mm-hmm. Throughout, on the art tip, I would like everyone to pay special attention to all the lighting stuff that Nick Filardi has been doing. Like this scene where Jenkins is at the desk, it's not scripted for him to be sitting in shadow like
that,
but that's such
brilliant.
A great dramatic like, you know, he's got the shades drawn. He's just waiting for something to come through the door. It's very much like an old school police drama stakeout sort of feel to it. Stuff like that, I really love that non-scripted stuff that really kind of builds on the artwork. Really,
well, I'm glad you pointed that out. Constantly. I didn't even.
Yeah, he does it constantly. Yeah,
think that wasn't the intention for that frame. That's great.
Yeah, it's funny. In my head, I have how I see things, and sometimes it's exactly what I thought, and sometimes I can't remember if I had a particular opinion one way or the other on this panel. But it does fit in so perfectly with the mood that I had in my head while I was drawing that panel. So I mean, he just reads me really well.
The lighting outside also has a really nice touches of sunlight and bleeds that cover the lines and kind of help bring mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, the knockouts on some of the line work to soften things up and create depth is really cool. So then we're in South America.
And Science City, the crater that used to be Science City.
yes.
So that's a popular subject these days.
Is it?
Manhattan Projects touched on something very similar, if not the same idea, recently. Basically, secret Cold War massive mega facilities.
Mm.
And I was wondering, what's the history behind those?
There is it's a real conspiracy theory. It is utterly bullshit because it's so crazy. But I love it because it is just the most bonkers out there, perfect conspiracy theory. I read about it in this book that I picked up in a used bookstore. It's called something like The Fantastic Inventions of Nikola Tesla. And I bought it because it had a bunch of his speeches and documents and some of his patents and some of his diagrams. And I just thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And I'm reading through it, and it's super interesting. And then I turn a page to this new chapter, and it's something, it deals with Atlantis. Like, okay. All the rest of this book had been, you know, factual, historic, documented speeches and patents, and then now the Atlantis connection. The basic premise of the book they're from was that, let me see if I can remember all the ways that it worked. Marconi sets up an underground research facility the size of a city in I think it was an unspecified mountain somewhere in South America, or may have simply been underground and no mountain. And that's where the Nazi space program was created. It's where all UFOs come from, because that's the technology they made. It's based on Atlantean technology that the Nazis had uncovered, I guess never used in the war.
Yeah.
Tesla went there. Tesla faked his own death. Marconi faked his own death. A bunch of scientists did to move into Science City and to produce these technological wonders. And they still visit us today in the form of flying saucers.
That sounds totally plausible. I don't know why you sound so skeptical. Skeptical.
I sound all those things.
You do.
Because when I see UFOs, I don't see Nikola Tesla at the helm. So anyway, it's this crazy and amazing conspiracy theory. And I was like, well, this toned down just a bit. This is absolutely perfect for a roboplot. So here we have one of those instances where the continuity exists and there's history to what Science City is. And there's an upcoming volume that deals with it. Back in the 60s, but we don't know that yet because it hasn't happened yet, but it has happened to Robo, so he talks about it.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, so that's a lot to take in. Is this crazy crackpot theory or some variation of it actually something that goes beyond the guy who wrote that book you read? Is it like bigger than him?
Oh, yeah.
That is the only place I've seen it referenced.
No. What about Science City?
Lost City of Z?
Yeah, Lost City of Z. That's kind of I thought that was part of the.
That has nothing to do with it. That is a whole other Lost City legend.
Oh, okay. Sorry, my bad. I'm getting them confused at this point. There's too many of them.
There's always, especially towards the later half of the 19th century, exploration into South America was extremely difficult. We just didn't quite have the technology to send teams of men in there and to get them back alive. Or they couldn't go very far because of all the disease and so on. Also, they went in with very European ideas of how to live off the land versus how the native peoples who have lived there for many thousands of years are able to thrive off the land. And but, you know, well, we're white, so we know better. Oh, we're all dying somehow.
And
yeah. And so there were all these legends that there were fantastic cities full of gold or whatever,
right.
Or whatever you wanted there to be cities full of and riches to go explore.
Crazy white people.
Yeah, white people problems, am I right?
Dying in the Amazon.
this is what we do.
It was crazy. Man, hey,
if we could rewind just a sec, I would like to, I forgot to point this out. Because sure. I pointed something like this out when we did the podcast at Heroes Con about the film reference for the opening of the Futurosaurus Rex Free Comic Book Day story. People seem to really dig on the Dr. Strangelove reference. But Robo's environmental suit that he's wearing in the jungle here is based on the Star Trek, the original series, environmental suits that they wore several times.
Nice.
We changed the colors a bit because silver suits with bright blue and red piping was just too obnoxious, but the basic design is the Star Trek environmental suit from the 60s.
That's very cool. Means
technically, when the Federation comes into existence in the future of Robo's world,
they won't base those
Tesla Dyne designs.
Yes, that's exactly what that means.
I eagerly anticipate the 1960s Robo story where we learn about Science City, but I guess all things in good time, man.
Yep. Atomic Robo and the Spear of Destiny. Where do we have to change that?
I think that's it.
Yeah, we had another one, but then that fun movie with the Nazis on the moon happened. And we had to change it, yeah. I mean, on what page is this? The page after Jenkins, the CEO, when they first spot the mountain and they start, and Robo has to hoist them up the side of the mountain.
Yeah.
So Brian does this thing where Robo is constantly grabbing large groups of people and just chucking them around like they're not meat sacks made of fragile bones. It's always a fun challenge to figure out, well, how would you actually do this without him having just literally grabbing all three of them by the necks in like a giant headlock and carrying them up the side of the mountain here.
So Brian didn't say Robo fashions some kind of a device.
No, that was me having a little Gilligan's Island moment there. Like, what can we do with coconuts and baling wire?
My thinking was that they would all just sort of desperately hang on to this one harness.
Yeah. Or the other visual in my head was very Princess Bride-y, where Andre the Giant is climbing the cliffs of despair. And he's got everyone in the it's kind of tied to him as he climbs, but that felt a little too hard to draw. So
yeah. This is a great panel.
But hard to draw, given the time I have to devote to. That would make an awesome like single illustration just to do for fun, but as one of six or seven panels I have to get done in a day, that was not happening. It's always a trade-off, man. Where are we now? The warehouse, right?
Yeah, more film references. You got one of the alien loaders in there.
I do have an alien loader in there, yeah. We got to move all these heavy science boxes around somehow, right?
It only makes sense.
Yeah.
And here we have the return of action scientist Phil.
With a different color Hawaiian shirt this time.
He's got a wide collection.
The other thing about, does Phil even own Hawaiian shirts? I'm sure he does, but I don't think I've ever actually seen him in one. But it feels to me like a Hawaiian shirt is the perfect visual representation of Phil's personality.
Yeah.
I've been trying to mystify him to bring back all the original scientists. So this is Benjamin again, not quite looking like he used to, but I'm trying to integrate everyone.
New art style, hairstyles change.
Yeah. But I'm trying to kind of streamline everyone and bring them into like all the same school of thought on how they're put together and how they look and whatnot.
Honestly, when it comes to action scientists, most of the time, unless they're fellas who have been in the spotlight as much as, say, Bernard, I can't really keep track of all of them in my head. But
yeah, that is the problem with using people we know also.
You know, for everybody who actually does have a good mental archive of, you know, action scientists from the past, there's so many stories that take place all over time. I'm sure, you know, seeing all these guys again is awesome.
Yeah, I wanted to bring back all the Volume 1 guys in this wherever I could. They weren't specifically scripted, I don't think. It was just like random action scientist one, or Brian decided he really hated me this time and kept scripting in friends of ours that we'd used as action scientists once or twice in the past, and trying to remember how to draw these people. It was like just not happening. I was very happy with the way these nighttime pages printed. And again, I think it's a switch to the different paper stock, because I think I'm buying
a strong chance of being far too dark.
Yeah. A couple of the nighttime pages in Volume 7 printed too darkly, and you know, they still read okay, but they looked much better digitally. Like the contrast between the night skies and the darker islands and stuff like that was much better digitally. This stuff printed really well. Really happy with it.
Robo's description of himself here strikes me as strange.
Yeah, I really like that. Was a nice little touch. Both the whole kind of revelation of how he sees it being difficult, being essentially immortal. Yeah. And the fact that he sees himself as a billionaire, even though he's not.
Yeah, I thought that was very telling as well. There's not often too many opportunities for reflective moments like that. So it's good to check in with him every now and then.
Yeah, it is always nice when we can do that. So then we've got Robo and crew diving into, well, not really Hollow Earth, diving into the ruins of Science City.
And they meet these Bunker Buster kids.
Yeah.
The hapless Scooby gang of would-be adventurers. Bunker busting getting more popular, I suppose. And we
is that a real thing? I didn't even.
Yeah, well, you know, urban exploration and anything. I don't know. I don't the term bunker busting. I don't hear thrown around too much.
No, but yeah, the whole urban exploration thing is that is for sure a thing.
I'm not familiar with anybody.
I'm pretty sure this was specifically inspired by these guys going around the underground of Las Vegas because it looks like it would be an abandoned science bunker. There's like this whole little, or there was, I don't know if there still is, this whole like little society of nomads living there. I think they all went to Albuquerque. I think that's where they live now.
Yeah, New York for a while had, or they still do. There was a book, I think it was called Life with the Mole People or something like that, where some author went and studied homeless people who were living underground in New York and just kind of making it work.
On the topic of bunker busting, there's a game called Infra, which is on Steam Greenlight right now, which is actually it's a first person exploratory game. Like there's no shooting involved. It's more of a maybe Myst-esque puzzle solver sort of thing. But it's all about exploring abandoned facilities like this and taking pictures and stuff like that. It's definitely something that's bubbling up in the collective consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. It was certainly interesting to draw. There wasn't a lot of guidelines to go by because we didn't know how destroyed Science City should be or should not be. And I didn't want to lock in any concrete designs that I would then have to kind of somewhat be loyal to when we eventually get around to telling the story of Science City. So we meet the bunker busters, and then we go back to Phil's awkward conversation with the nuclear regulatory people. And then we go back to Hollow Earth again. I had no idea what to do as far as what you would see and what you wouldn't see. So I just had like random buildings and pipes and stuff sticking out of the walls.
Like inner devices. Big ones.
Yeah. Big ones.
It looks like it took a beating, whatever happened to it.
That's what we were going for.
Nicely vague. Well done, Scott.
Excellent. Thank you.
It looks great.
I was really, having no idea what I was doing going into it. I was very happy with the way this panel worked out. And I really, again, with the way the coloring and the paper are working, I really like how all the little teeny tiny figures, they are all distinct and you can pick them all out. And they are super tiny.
Yeah, it was hard to see them on the black and white, just the line work.
Yeah.
You know, going over lettering and so on. But, you know, Nick puts these colors on and they pop.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we're reaching the climax of this first issue where things get real dicey and the big expected Dr. Dinosaur reveal is on.
I imagine by this point people are sort of like feeling their conflicts
and
realizing that there are four more pages in their left hand and than there are in their right hand. They haven't seen a dinosaur yet. And
what gives?
Getting angry at it.
It's a good thing you didn't put them on the cover. Otherwise, they would have been just mad. Mad.
Yeah.
I do like that we get our very first hint that something is strange here from Bernard, just mentioning these crystal formations, and then the missile happens.
Yeah, and RPGs. It's why not?
I absolutely love the Bernard fly you fools moment. It's just, I mean, you realize he's one of your stars now. You can't get rid of him at this point.
Well, that's cool. No, because like I said, like for me personally, he's always been one of my favorite action scientists. And Brian and I've had several conversations about what to do with him after this. Because in the Hollow Earth story, for me anyway, the Hollow Earth story is really more about Bernard finally discovering his inner hero after decades of being this cowardly, craven
lab guy
who doesn't want to be an action scientist.
He's more of an inaction scientist.
He survived the vampire dimension invasion at that time, and so he's forced to work in the field. There was no room, but I really wanted to work in some jokes about like when they're flying out to South America here, where he's basically like a cross between a grizzled Vietnam veteran and just this neurotic New Yorker who is just like, you know, why are they sending out a mission? Like, I'm short. I'm supposed to retire. I'm being reassigned to lab work next week. And then he's, you know, he gets sucked in to get another adventure.
I really like the panel layout when they all fall in the pink gel.
It's not gel, it's water.
It looks delicious, Scott.
You're just thinking of Ghostbusters, too.
Yeah, you are thinking of Ghostbusters. It's made of bad thoughts. Oh, man, how did such a shitty movie come out of such a great movie? I don't understand that.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the second one. However,
it's terrible. It has moments. It has moments that are great, but it's mostly terrible.
Weirdly enough, they actually salvaged a lot of the bullshit plot of the second one in the video game. They made it weirdly credible.
Yes. And the video game, I think, was a much better Ghostbusters movie than the second Ghostbusters movie was.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, we have our Gandalf moment with Bernard. And then we had the Gandalf in the Balrog cave here fall into the water and or Jello, however you would like to conceptualize
that. Or they all die. And that's sad.
Yeah. That would have been no good. So, okay, on the next page, after they fall to things, so I was desperate to get Robo out of this big, stupid spacesuit because I couldn't do it.
Let me preface this. this was one of those problems for Scott Wegener, created by Scott Wegener.
Yes. Yes.
I want to put that out there.
I don't know. I'm not blaming you on this on you at all. So it was really fun to have Robo in the suit and do the whole Star Trek callback thing. But then drawing it again and again and again and getting the neck collar and all that stuff. Right. So I kept taking components off as we went, as he would as he got to higher and higher altitudes where bug invasions of his innards were less likely, could take the helmet off and undo some of the life support cables and stuff. But then I thought, well, there's all these bits where he's battling in Hollow Earth, and I don't want him to be in this big, dumpy garbage bag of a suit. So I figured, well, when they go into the water, everyone swims to shore. And I don't think this was in the script. It was just Robo pops up after everyone is on shore. It was everyone pops to the surface, and then Robo, using the line that they had all followed into the hole, using that rope, then pulls them to shore is what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But instead, I thought it'd be more fun if he sank down, but because he had the helmet off, all the air in the suit goes to his boots. And so he lands his head first on the bottom. And I think I scripted some dialogue for this, but that didn't make it into the final cut of the... It sometimes does, but not often. So all the air goes to Robo's feet, and he's kind of stuck down there and has to ditch the environmental suit.
That's a nice detail. The actuality of it hadn't really ever reached me, but but knowing that all those gears are turning without me ever having to think about it.
Yeah, it's not important. Thinking story. It's like Disney. Leave the imagining to us, okay? We'll take care of it.
Here's our second hint that things are weird. This underground body of water is not ice cold. How strange.
Would it always be? Because temperatures get extremely hot the further down you go, and then they get cold again. And then.
Well, it depends on where you are.
I suppose. Okay, yeah, but it is strange. It's like a hot tub.
Also strange that it looks like pink jelly.
Yeah, also that, yeah.
That part's quite strange.
So delicious.
The convenient Journey to the Center of the Earth lighting. If you have never seen the classic Journey to the Center of the Earth, you really have to.
I haven't.
It's terrible, and it's awesome. And everything is like this page with all the pink crystals and super weird Technicolor stuff. And they dress like they're going for a hike on the moors of Scotland to explore the center of the Earth. It's pretty amazing.
How do you know that the center of the Earth isn't exactly like Scotland?
It could be. I'm trying to remember who was the main character, the young guy in that. Daniel Boone. So, of course, there had to be songs. And so there were. And they were terrible.
Songs?
Yeah, there's two songs, maybe three. He falls in love with the professor's daughter, and he courts her with his songs. And they're amazing.
I know it's unrealistic, but I managed to bring my guitar down here. I thought I'd play you a couple tunes.
And my whole band.
I like to think it's just the power of love that kept my instrument intact.
Oh, now it's Huey Lewis. Oh, man. And then we finally reveal Dr. Dinosaur.
On page 21 of 22.
God, you jerks.
And again, awesome shadow casting from Nick here. And really, you'll see it more in issue two, but he plays on the line work of the rocks and does the shading the same way I'm kind of drawing the seams and the crevices in the rock. And it looks really cool.
Yes.
And according to him, it takes forever. And he hates me for giving him that idea. And now he has to stick with it until he's done.
It's kind of his problem for being really good at his job.
He does what I do, in that he comes up with great ideas and then creates problems for himself, and he realizes that he has to reproduce that great idea again and again and again and again. Yeah, and then I felt we needed some more unscripted stuff here, because the little moment with Robo and his eye twitch, it's kind of how I feel every time I see Dr. Dinosaur in a script.
it's perfect. Yeah, it's exactly what needed to be there.
There's a little self-insertion going on here in these three panels next to Dr. Dinosaur's reveal.
The quiet moment where Robo looks back at the team.
Yeah, that was another weird little non-scripted one, but just like, it's funny, there's all these things that I see in my head from reading Brian's scripts that are not in Brian's scripts, but there's like, they're almost like unconsciously implied by it, and then I have to figure out a way to cram that in somehow.
And that's why you guys are such a good team.
Could be.
So are we to believe that that is in fact a living pterodactyl that Dr. Dinosaur is riding?
I would not call that a pterodactyl, but
Pterodactoid,
yeah. The creatures of Hollow Earth are not based on anything real. Well, they're inspired by, but they're supposed to be, you know, Hollow Earth versions.
They're imagineered to be.
They are imagineered, yes. I was pretty much just going for fun and interesting shapes with this thing. This whole volume with all the monsters and stuff, I've really been enjoying Andrew McLean's work on everything I see, and he is like extremely graphic in his work. Like it's very abstracted and
Very exaggerated, elongated.
Yeah, it's just really cool stuff, and so I've just been really enjoying that.
I'm not familiar with his name. What's he known for?
Nothing, unfortunately, yet. He will be. He's kind of new to the scene. Headloppers just came out. Did an issue or two of a Kickstarter project called Meat Space. Took out the first issue of it. I really love that. And then there's Department O, which I don't think has come out yet, which is kind of like a great like Victorian era X-Files sort of thing.
Okay, that's cool.
Which people might be inclined to say, oh, that's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but it's not. Very different. Yeah, I don't know quite how to explain it, but yeah, his stuff is just really cool. You can just Google his name, follow him on Tumblr, follow him on Instagram. He's just an amazing artist and a super nice guy. And I found my one conundrum here, the last panel on page 21 here. So everyone just crawled out of the underground lake and they should all be drenched, but I didn't want to draw like, you know, everything I'm doing is super simplified. So I want to draw like little water droplets on everyone and all that jazz. So I said, oh, well, their hair will just be kind of stuck down to their head and whatnot. And then I realized there's only one person in Hollow Earth that actually has hair on their head. And everyone's just going to assume I forgot how to draw Lang's hair.
Maybe. Didn't cross my mind. I've read it a couple times at this point, so.
Maybe it's not obvious. I mean, it was just one of those things that occurred to me and then I worried about too much, probably.
Sounds like that.
Yeah. And then on page 22, we see more of Nick's amazing lighting and shading going on here.
Yeah, that must have been terrible.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
That drawing looks like that was rough.
Yeah. Yeah, it took a long time to draw, but it took even longer to shade in everything. God, can't imagine.
That poor bastard.
Well, I can. That's why we hire someone else to do it, because I won't.
Looking absolutely great.
Thanks. Yeah, I was really happy with the way this came out.
So that's the end of issue one. I guess we just should do some questions now.
Sure. Do we have any?
From the fans. If you want to ask Brian or Scott a question about this volume or other volumes, but mostly this volume, you can ask us on the Nerdy Show forums. You can find a link to where you can do that at nerdyshow.com/AtomicRobo, along with all of our other episodes. Or you could tweet at us with the hashtag AskRobo. So, we have a few questions. These are all from Sean. And he says, Atomic Robo is the only comic he's collected in years. Keep up the good work.
It's not a question.
I agree. You're loving it, Sean. You read it. Don't worry about collecting it. Just because you buy it and you own it, you don't have to collect it. Just enjoy it. But he wants to know, will Two-Fisted Tales stories be collected in print once there's enough of them?
No, Two-Fisted Tales is Tarantula. Remember, it can't be printed. We did that digital comic to specifically not be printable because we were asked to do it by a digital comic company to highlight their new software. So we figured, well, we'll go all out. Now, future Two-Fisted Tales stories, which everyone involved wants to do more. We don't have anything specific in mind just yet. We might do those so that they are printable at some point, but there's really nothing planned. I would say once there is enough, if we can print them, we will. Some of them will just never, it won't be possible.
I mean, personally, I think that Tarantula was so phenomenal as using the medium. You know, I kind of hope you don't ever collect them. I hope they're all that immersive in the digital scope, unless you guys are like, oh no, too exhausting, not going to do it again.
You know, it wasn't that bad. Once I wrapped my head around how to work it, it wasn't any more work than doing a regular issue of Robo, really.
Yeah, it was about as much content and took about as long once we figured it out, and now that we have.
So we had like 110 panels or something like that, and then an editor at Marvel had emailed me last week about doing layouts for their 12-page digital exclusive stories, and they were talking like, you know, 50 to 60 panels, which is half of what we did. So I think everyone has kind of got that number roughly in mind for creating parity between the two. Yeah.
He'd also like to know if Atomic Robo Last Stop is considered to be in canon, and when we could expect the DVD to hit stores.
I don't think the DVD will ever hit stores. It's not really for sale.
Kickstarter only?
Yeah. It'll be on YouTube and such.
The people who back the Kickstarter will get a DVD copy, but it won't be for sale. There's no plans for that. Is that canon? I don't know if that could be. You wrote the script.
Yeah, well, I wrote it to not specifically contradict anything that we have established or plan to do. And they took the script and kind of expanded upon it because they wanted to do a bigger project. And I went over that and just kept an eye out for the very same, you know, concerns. And it passes that test. I don't know if it's official, it plausibly could be.
There's no reason it can't be. Man, we're just answering all this guy's great questions with super vague, non-committal sort of responses.
By the time you hear this, you can watch it. You don't have to pay any money to watch it. You can just watch it wherever. That's helpful.
I hope that's an okay answer, but some people maybe want their collections to be complete so that when the internet is abolished, they'll still be able to watch DVDs. I don't know.
Gary Yer wants to know, are we going to see direct references to Robo upgrading himself over time, or is it going to remain as headcanon?
You know, I don't know. It's something that he does. Early on, actually, when we started doing Robo, we had tossed the idea around of coloring the volumes in such a way that they would be in the tones that Robo would have experienced them.
What?
So early on, Robo probably only saw in black and white.
Yeah.
21st century, Robo sees in high definition 3D. You know, so his experience of the world and his GPS and all that stuff. So at least within our own minds, yes, Robo does constantly upgrade himself. And the way he makes room for it all is that as material sciences have improved, he has replaced pretty much everything inside himself at this point, except for his brain, with newer and newer materials.
And presumably his engine, the energy, the fusion reactor, or whatever it is.
I don't know. I wouldn't have thought he would upgrade that.
I think that he's replaced the fuel, certainly, several times. Whoa. But I don't know if the device itself is newer or not.
That's true, yeah. I mean, not knowing enough, I'll have to consult with action scientist Phil on that one. But yeah, I mean, he's got to refuel himself, what, every 7 to 10 years, we said?
I forget what it is.
There is a number that we got worked out by an actual
nuclear
scientist.
That's cool.
So he does have to replace his fuel rods. And so, yeah, so by using these newer materials to upgrade his skeleton, his armor, and whatnot, it literally frees up space inside of him to put other stuff into. And going way back, the original Robo had, his guns and stuff were mounted on him. So in the 40s, he had, like, you know, a Browning machine gun strapped that would bolt onto his forearm, and then they were laser blasters in the present and stuff, or lightning blasters, whatever. But it was all just a little too, they were all neat ideas, but they were just like not important enough to keep
his character. Cooler this way.
I think he is a lot cooler this way. Yeah, more relatable, definitely. Although I am looking forward to, and I think it's still volume 10, like exploring the idea of him not being human at all, but that's a different podcast. But yeah, we've never actually in the book talked about upgrading anything, have we?
It's kind of like it's a downtime kind of thing.
Which, yeah, exactly. Because we had talked about bringing it up in volume 6 when they have to reconstruct about half of him after he falls from space. And having something in there about how, well, you know, we changed out these buffers for this new thing and then upgraded this, and this while we were in there. But it didn't move the narrative forward at all. So
yeah. It was a very packed volume to begin with, and we have to cut stuff like that.
Yeah, which I understand the desire, though, to see that in the comic, because I want to see that. I want to put that stuff in the comic, but for someone who just doesn't care about
it. It feels very Shiro, in a way. Very early, you know, Apple CV, walking to the lab, Robo's got his chest open or something, I don't know. We get to do the exploded view version of his new gear internals and stuff.
I think we'll finally get to, like I said, volume 10, I think we'll finally maybe get to actually verbalize some of that stuff in the itself.
It's very relevant to what is planned for volume 10.
Yeah.
So it would be totally impossible to see it, you know, on the page.
Yes. Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned Appleseed. I've been rereading them recently because I found that page, you know, last week while I was looking for photo reference, and I put it on Tumblr. And an artist I know, she'd never even heard of it before.
What?
And she's a super robot nerd, but she's only been reading comics for 5 years or so. So she's a young adult, and she's new to comics. So she's come to comics as an adult. I'd never heard of Appleseed. So I sang its praises, and I'm like, you've got to see if you can get copies of it. And then I thought, you know, I did this a few years ago too with Lindsay. She'd never read it, and I haven't read it in like 15 years at least, even 20 years. I look through it all occasionally, but it's weird. I learned how to especially looking now as I've gotten better at laying out pages. That's probably the biggest visual influence on me for storytelling, because he's really, really good at it. But the writing is so obtuse and so murky, and just, you know, and like many manga, it's full of like this pseudo philosophy garbage and an attempt to make it seem like more than what it is, which is just, you know, a cyborg and his girlfriend shooting things up. But like it's like a ham-fisted attempt at government conspiracy stuff.
They need to stop teaching Nietzsche in Japanese high schools.
They really do.
That's all they know, and that's all the philosophy that's in their
brain. They don't even know it. They have like the Cliff Notes version of it.
It's in every anime.
It is. Word. It is. But well, and that's why, you know, but that stuff so appeals to like a teenage, very young adult audience, because, you know, the pointlessness of your existence is what you're grappling with at that point in your life. So, you know, of course they love it. And as did we. But yeah, it was so interesting. So I had to touch base again with this friend and just be like, oh, man, I hope you don't hate this because I'm reading it. And it's just such a weird marriage of awful narrative married with beautiful visual storytelling. Which is odd, because I read Akira last year and I had no problem with it at all. Like, either the writing or the visuals, it all still holds up really, really well.
Ask a simple question and get a very complex answer. That's what you can look forward to if you hashtag Ask Robo. You never know what's going to happen, but man, you know, you might get an answer that says, well, something's coming out in a future volume. so that's cool.
Robo upgrading himself. Yeah, that's where we were.
So. This concludes our Volume 8 Issue 1 podcast. Look forward to more podcasts for every future issue of Volume 8. As far as other Robo news stuff, there is actually some pretty big things going on. The new Atomic Robo Kickstarter.
What?
Oh, you didn't hear about this?
I do not. I'm not involved.
There's this whole book. It says it's written by you.
When did I start a comic book?
No, it's not even a comic book. It's like I don't know, some kind of word book or something.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, it's this Kickstarter, you get this book, and then there's also a bunch of t-shirts and lab coats and stuff.
Okay, this sounds pretty cool, and I want some of that stuff.
Well, allegedly, though, since you're not involved, I honestly don't know what to make of it.
This is a bad way to do the interview.
Yeah, this is a bad way. Okay, just come clean, Brian. You're the mastermind behind this, aren't you?
Yes, I did the masterminding.
Okay.
Yeah, we are doing a Kickstarter for Atomic Robo. What we are Kickstartering specifically is the official Tesla Dyne Action Scientist Field Guide, which is a bit like, you know, those little survival books, or, you know, How to Survive a Zombie, whatever, or, you know, if your car is sinking, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's for weird sci-fi things that you never actually have to worry about. But they're the kind of things that happen all the time in, you know, sci-fi movies and comic books. You can think of it as an artifact from another more amazing world.
That's my favorite shit. Those are the merchandise that people produce for things. Those are the things I'm most inclined to buy.
So we got you down for the top tier then, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about it, but it was all maxed out last time I checked.
Oh, there's a new one.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you're prepared. Yeah, in case you haven't been following this, Brian and Scott asked for a paltry $7,500, and wow, they are in the tens of thousands now.
We're sitting at 57,000 as of this recording.
Yeah, so it's there's plenty of time yet to get on this. You can basically think about it as a book pre-order, and with that book pre-order comes any extra stuff you want.
There's a whole bunch of tiers. I don't know. They range from $10 all the way up to the completely insane $600 level, and
which people have done. And whoever you are, wow, you're awesome and loaded.
Yeah.
Consider supporting Nerdy Show. That's all I'm saying.
No, Robo first.
They've already thrown down $600. Obviously, Robo first, Brian.
Okay.
They only have to contribute $1 and we send them stuff. The Nerdy Show.
Oh, man. So. This is, you're making my deal look bad.
I don't know. You have burnt up lab coats. And are you in a position to explain some of these things you're offering here?
Yes. Any question, I will explain.
You've been quite vague about some of it. Okay, crystals.
Yeah.
What kind of crystals?
You have to say what it is. It's a genuine asterisk.
Yes.
Hollow Earth crystal.
Yeah, and actual crystals may vary. So yeah. What does that mean?
They're definitely crystals. Shut up. There's a certificate of authenticity signed by Dr. Dinosaur himself. Why would he lie?
I can't even imagine. are these crystals you grow yourself in the windowsill?
No, but that would be cool. We were actually thinking we might do like a little Action Scientist science kit later. Like, oh, okay. Not as part of this, it would have to be its own thing.
Yeah.
You should grow your own crystals in that case. These will be pre-existing crystals, you know, hewn from the very earth itself, from the hollow earth. You can't prove that they weren't.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, how about the star of the show, the Tesla Dyne Field Guide? How big a book is this?
Dimensions-wise, it will be about the size of a comic book. It is base 48 pages. Some of the stretch goals will boost that up. It's mostly text with some images and, you know, for illustrating certain points, maybe some graphs, crap like that. In terms of layout, I would liken it more to what a textbook or role-playing game supplement would look like as opposed to a comic book.
Is this a spinoff of the actual role-playing game thing that you've been working on?
No, there was some confusion with that. No, both provide world building information, but in different ways. Like for the RPG, you know, it gives you like all these dossiers and, you know, timelines and ideas for how to run different kinds of adventures from perspective of Robo or other, you know, factions, or what it would be like to be in Robo's world if Robo never existed or was taken out at different times, blah, blah, blah. This is more like world building around the edges in a way, because it's more talking about the kinds of things that just happen to exist in Robo's world and the way that the official Tesladyne action scientists are instructed to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly there's information in there that would be useful and relevant to the RPG, but they are totally unrelated products and you don't need either to enjoy the other.
So what's neat about what you guys have done so far is you had some stretch goals prepared, and they went, I mean, right now we're deep into the stretch goal territory, and it only gets crazier. I meant to, when you guys pass 70,000 and you get actual scientists on the book.
Yes, we definitely have one lockdown. I don't know if we're going to do more than that.
It says scientists plural. You have to do more than that.
Oh, well.
You screwed up. Let's see what else. Really cool posters. Buttons.
So many posters, so many buttons.
Mugs.
Oh, yeah.
T-shirts.
Yep.
Polo shirts.
Yep.
ID cards.
Mm-hmm.
Let me come clean. The thing that's been pushing me, like, ooh, look at these higher goals. All you really want's the book, but you could get this. The Space It's Out There poster.
Oh, yeah.
That one. That's the one.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely.
That's the one that's screwing up my mind meets right now, Brian.
See, here's the thing. That pack, that's the $100 tier.
Uh-huh.
That is our highest moving tier by like a huge margin.
Right.
I think it's all that poster.
I do too. I mean, that's
look
it.
Look at that guy. He's excited. He's happy.
All the posters are cool. That's the best one. You know what you did. Lab coats. Those are cool. And then some of them are set on fire.
Well, they will not be on fire when you get them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The mail, they frown on that.
How are you planning on doing this? Like, aerosol can and a lighter or what?
No, Cap. What has happened is that these are the lab coats that were salvaged or perhaps mailed back as a form of taunt from Dr. Dinosaur after he probably killed an actual science guy. And we're giving them to people. And they will be ruined. They will have been burned and destroyed in various ways, torn up, laser blasted, you know.
Shouldn't these be in an evidence cabinet somewhere?
Well, I mean, there's no body, you know.
Hmm.
It doesn't leave much.
Okay. We can overlook it. and the Action Scientist membership cards. You guys have a very rough mock-up.
The roughest possible mock-up ever.
It's kind of amazing you've been given so much money with a mock-up this rough.
I know. It was almost like a dare.
I kind of get the feeling you did this and not Scott. Am I right about that?
What tipped you off? Was it the crappy imagery? Is that what did it?
It was the paint, the obvious use of of some kind of simple paint program.
Yeah. Although I want to say that the image of the certificate of authenticity, that is pretty much exactly what it will look like.
Good. I think that's what people were actually paying for in that case. But what can people expect from the actual junior scientist card?
You know, it'll have your name. It'll have like an ID number. It'll have the little Tesladyne symbol. I don't know. Maybe there'll be more things on it. I don't know. We're leaving that up to our designer, our head designer, who had nothing to do with any of these images so far, which is why they look like crap.
They're probably pretty pissed at you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like as soon as the campaign went online, he's like, man, why didn't you contact me? I had a good reason. I was being a good man. The campaign went live about a week sooner than we had prepared, and I didn't want to, you know, just say, hey, Jeff, we need a ton of images and need them in an hour. Go.
Right. So is it safe to assume that the people who got these sets earlier will have lower ID numbers as Tesla employees?
Maybe. I have no idea how we're actually doing this.
Okay.
You're asking me like competent questions. I'm just the face of this thing.
Right, right. I got you. Okay, well, the atomic...
You're not looking at the brain here.
Who is the brain?
The actual shadow broker.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with him. He donated money to Nerdy Show a couple times.
Yeah, he does good work.
Yeah, he's good. Anyway, the Atomic Robo Needs You Tesladyne Recruitment Drive, it's out there. We'll have a link to it on this episode's page. And, you know, if you want this this Tesladyne book... Well, get in now and choose your format, and you're probably going to want to throw down $100. Just saying, Space, it's out there. And guys, you mentioned that the Atomic Robo RPG was right around the corner at the Heroes Con panel. Is that still the case? What's the word?
The lead designer just posted a blog post about it. They were finishing revisions on, or they did finish fun revisions on, I believe, the last chapter, and it is now just in layout, and that's like literally the last step before it goes to print. So we're getting there.
It's coming out very soon. I thought it was this month, but it's not this month, is it? Is it next month?
Well, yeah, we were really hoping it would be in July, but you know, just the realities of, you know, crunching all that text and making it look good and sound right.
Yeah. So very soon, but it's we can't give you a specific date.
Yeah.
Any other Robo things people should keep an eye out for?
We got more Real Science Adventures coming out. Although I don't know when, but the 9th issue, which is the 3rd issue of the current storyline, will be out quote unquote soon, and more volume 8.
Cool. Well, for more Atomic Robo nuts and bolts, just head over to nerdyshow.com/AtomicRobo, and for all your Atomic Robo needs, atomic-robo.com. And more critical Robo links will be on this episode's page, of course. Thanks so much for listening. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Brian, and I still think nuts and bolts is funny.
I'm Scott. I have nothing.
That's right, because you're the artist.
Oh.
Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts is brought to you by Nerdy Show. If you somehow enjoyed what you've heard, you can show your support by telling a friend or going to nerdyshow.com and clicking the support button. Even a small contribution gets you cool nerdy perks, possibly crystals, and allows you to take part in our monthly support drive contests. For more episodes of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts, videos, contests, and other nerdy programming, visit nerdyshow.com. Subscribe to all the Nerdy Show Network's latest episodes via the iTunes Store, and remember to follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Nerdy Show and Dr. Dinosaur. For all Atomic Robo news, go to atomic-robo.com, a highly inefficient URL.
I'm just realizing how different Dr. Dinosaur's helmet is here in issue 1 from what I'm drawing now in issue 4.
You know,
who cares?
Crystals grow and change.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it's like, you know, those things you put in the windowsill.
Plants.
Those.
Dead babies.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's a comic for kids.
Well, what are you, George Lucas? Talking about the Trade Federation and all that?
Let's talk about regulations.
Very exciting. This comic would be so much better if I never read it.